For the past 4 years, Connie and Michael have been traveling continuously throughout the U.S. and Canada, sharing their passion for what they call evolutionary spirituality with religious and secular audiences across the spectrum of belief. A biologist by training, Connie Barlow is best known as a writer of popular science books, including Evolution Extended, Green Space, Green Time, and The Ghosts of Evolution. Michael Dowd is a former evangelical pastor and the author of Earth Spirit, a handbook for nurturing an ecological Christianity. In addition to being life partners, what these itinerant evolutionary evangelists share in common is a commitment to helping birth a hopeful new paradigm in which science and spirit come together and give us the inspiration to transform the world. Join us for the next hour as we explore the emergence of evolutionary spirituality with our guests, Michael Dowd and Connie Barlow. My name is Craig Hamilton. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Connie and Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, Craig.
Great to have you here. You, about 4 years ago, left behind hearth and home and struck out on the road to share your passion for the evolutionary story. I would like to hear a little bit about, for each of you, what inspired you to do that and just kind of the story, in a sense, that led up to this radical move.
Well, we were living just north of New York City. In fact, when 9/11 happened, Connie was supposed to be at World Trade Tower 1 the very next morning and for class. And so a lot of us in that part of the country, really a lot of all over, were assessing our priorities in our lives. And about 2 or 3 weeks after that, PBS showed a 7-part special that was really one of the best things, if not the best thing, that's ever been done on television around evolution. And when that program was done, well, the last program was called What About God? And they were interviewing science majors at Wheaton College, which was an evangelical school that teaches evolution. Most evangelical colleges and seminaries teach evolution, actually. Most evangelicals don't know that, but that's the case. Mm. And they were grappling with how to hold on to their faith, their Christian faith, and how to hold on to evolution, what they were being taught. And they were getting no support from their families or their pastors. And so this was the tension. And when that program was done, Connie looked at me and she said, you know, you need to be out there speaking to these students, because the best that they were being offered was that their faith could be reconciled to science. Hmm. And she said, what you're saying is that their faith can be strengthened and deepened and enriched by evolution. And then just a few weeks after that, I came home from work one day. I was doing this environmental sustainability work. And it was wonderful work, but I had to do a lot of phone calling. And I came home and I just was kind of whining. And I said to Connie, I said, you know, I just wish we could travel, just like live permanently on the road, teaching and preaching this sacred evolutionary perspective. And she looked me square in the eyes and she said, I would love to do that. And we stayed looking into each other's eyes until I started to cry. And we realized, this is going down. So that's kind of how it began.
And I really couldn't do anything else, because I had for, 15 years been working entirely 3 years at a time on books relating to evolution. And so evolution had been my life and my worldview in the deepest way. And I was at the time grappling around a little bit. Do I really want to start another 3-year book project? And if so, what would it be? So it was perfect timing for me to be able to launch off, stay in the evolutionary worldview, but launch into just kind of jump off the cliff a little bit. And this time with a mission partner rather than being on my own writing a book by myself.
What's it been like then since you made the big leap, and you've been for 4 years now constantly on the road, right?
Permanently. We don't have a home or a storage bin. We live permanently traveling all over North America, living out of the generosity of people who open up their homes to us. So we don't have an RV. We've got a large van. It's a high-top Mercedes van called a Dodge Sprinter. And it's our bedroom on wheels and storage. But we live with people in their homes, typically, although we often sleep in the van. And it's the first year and a half was challenging. It really was, Craig. Part of it was that Connie and I were very different people. I had been married once before, had a 13-year marriage. Connie had never been married. And we came from very different backgrounds, expectations, and everything else. And so for the first year and a half, we were just trying to adjust to each other, much less this living life, you know, traveling lifestyle, living in people's homes. We went in the Pacific Northwest 2.5 years ago and did some counseling together, because we wanted our marriage to be commensurate with the mission that we felt that we were both called to. So there's been some challenges, but the last 2.5 years have largely been, I don't know, we play to each other's strengths. I do what I'm good at and what I love doing. She does what she's good at and what she loves doing. And fortunately, there's not a whole lot that falls between the cracks. And we both feel kind of like in athletes sort of in peak performance, where just what we do is pretty natural and effortless. And it's so these last 2.5 years have, you know, there's been a couple of hard points, but mostly it's been just flowing and fulfilling and just deeply meaningful.
Well, we've learned, too. I mean, I've learned that if I'm living and sleeping in the van, I really need to be somewhere in the South during the winter.
Why is that?
And it's just you know, trying to live in it. In fact, last week, it was exactly a week ago when we were coming down to California. We had no idea that Klamath Falls, Oregon, is 4,200 feet elevation. So we pull into there, and we had been in really no snow while we were in the Seattle area, and we get into there, and we sleep out the first night, and it's 19 degrees in the van, and the second night, it's 9 degrees. We're sleeping in the van at 9 degrees, and I'm thinking, I don't think so. But within 12 hours, we were able to make it to Napa Valley and end up in a hot tub.
Okay.
Ah, California.
Joys of being mobile. Okay.
Yes, yes. Indeed.
Weather gets bad, you just get on the road. And what is it that you're doing when you're on the road? What kind of talks are you giving? Who are you speaking to? Give me a sort of a month in the life of Connie and Michael on the road.
Well, we know what we're doing every Sunday. Every Sunday.
Yeah.
Every Sunday we're in either one church with Michael generally doing the sermon and me doing the religious education for kids, or as we are this coming Sunday, we're in two different churches and he and I are each doing a guest sermon in a church.
So we do that. So every Sunday we're in at least one church, sometimes two. And then I also do follow-up workshops, free follow-up workshops for both churches independently. So like, for example, this week we're two different churches on Sunday morning. And then next week I'm going to be doing a follow-up workshop, two-hour workshop for each church, one on Monday night, one on Wednesday night. So we always do that. And then we also, whenever we're invited, we do programs in college or high school, grade school classrooms, occasionally a environmental organization or different
homeschooling. We've done for homeschooling programs.
Right.
It's basically, Michael doesn't know how to say no. He says yes. Anybody who asks him, and provided we're, you know, in driving distance, he says yes.
And we do programs in Christian churches as well as a lot of Unitarian Universalist churches, New Thought, Religious Science, as well as occasionally like a Quaker Meeting House or Buddhist Meditation Center. So really quite the gamut, except we don't get invited into the most fundamentalist of circles.
Mm-hmm. A little bit ago, you said that you feel that religious faith can not only be reconciled. In a sense, you said this was the inspiration for your desire to go on the road, was, you know, we wanted to push beyond this idea that it could not only be reconciled with evolution, but that evolution could become a sort of basis. The understanding of evolution, an evolving cosmos, evolving life, could become a sort of basis for a spiritual or religious worldview. How do those two go together? Because obviously the way most of us have learned about evolution is it's mechanistic, natural selection, random mutation, etc.
The way it goes together is that coming to an understanding that the universe is one unfolding, complexifying process that human beings are part of, we're an expression of. The way I sometimes say it is that we didn't come into the world, we grew out of it, in the same way that peaches grew out of a peach tree. So the universe has gone from simple atoms to more complex atoms to molecules to more complex molecules to creatures and more complex creatures and then societies and more complex societies. And it's one unfolding process, which, of course, you know, people like Julian Huxley and Teilhard de Chardin and others have talked about, and Thomas Berry. But this sense allows us to see all religions as playing a vital role. Every religion has a piece of the story, a way of understanding our relationship to the whole and our relationship to each other in that process, but it does so based on the metaphors and analogies of their different regions. And so this science-based understanding is the first time that we have a creation myth, a creation story, a narrative of the big picture, where did we come from, why are we here, where are we going, that makes all other stories right. See, that's why we call it the great story. We call the universe story, told in a sacred, meaningful way, the great story, simply because it includes and embraces all other stories. There's no story left out. No cultural story, no religious story.
Tell me a little bit about what you mean when you say the great story.
Michael's take on this is really unique, and I'd say that's the reason we're on the road. It's because of Michael's take on it. Michael is the one who comes from a theistic, strong theistic background, having been a minister. I'm an evolutionary humanist. I'm a science writer. I'm a Unitarian Universalist of the humanist stock. And so for me, coming to be comfortable with using the word God and spirituality has been something new for me. I am comfortable using it now, but it's something new for me. And when I speak, I'm really speaking to the converted. I'm speaking to people in Unitarian Universalist audiences, college audiences, Montessori schools where the cosmic story is taught and so forth. And so for me, the great story is something that I'm already talking to people who say yes to science. Yes, we want to have our children learn in their curriculum in religious education programs, liberal religious education programs, that they are made of stardust, that their ancestors include stars in the sky, as Carl Sagan said, you know, that we are made of star stuff. So I am already speaking to a very small part of the audience, to the converted. It's Michael who's the one who's really taking it, taking this evolutionary story into places where Carl Sagan was never able to go.
Hmm. You just said something. You said we're made of star stuff. Could you elaborate a little bit on what that means?
Yeah. What it means, in fact, this is something that's so exciting for me because I went through an entire science education, biology and other sciences, and never learned the fundamental principle of where do all the chemical elements come from. And in fact, this was discovered in 1959. I could have been taught it. The chemical elements, all except the hydrogen and helium, that's right now the lightest elements, all of the carbon in our cells, all of the calcium in our bones, all of the iron in our blood, all of the oxygen that we breathe, was once inside the bellies of giant stars that lived and died before our sun was born. And that's important, that lived and died. To me, having a creation story in which death is natural in the heavens is a wondrous way to introduce our youth to not be fearful of death.
Now, Michael, I get the sense that you haven't always necessarily been an evolutionary evangelist. In fact, your background, you were an evangelical Christian and a pastor and trained in that tradition. Tell me a bit about what shifted for you in that.
I was raised Roman Catholic, and then when I was in Berlin, Germany in the late 1970s, I had a born-again experience, and it was very profound. It was a total transformation of my life, and it was in an Assemblies of God context. So the books I was reading, the people I hung out with, were all very anti-evolution. They didn't embrace, you know, they were young earth creationists. And so I, too, became a young earth creationist. And so I went to Evangel University. It's affiliated with the Assemblies of God in Springfield, Missouri. And while I was there, the first day I walked into biology class, the teacher held up a textbook that we were going to use, and it taught evolution because I knew that because I had used that same textbook 4 years earlier at the University of Miami, Florida. And I couldn't believe it. In fact, I picked up my books. I walked out of class. I slammed the door. I went to the registrar's office, and I withdrew from the course. In fact, I told my roommate, Satan obviously has a foothold in the school. It was the only way I could make sense of that.
Wow.
And so it was really the patience and the love of some of my fellow students, as well as the biblical studies and philosophy professors, all of whom embraced evolution, and clearly they were very Christ-centered people. And so I couldn't write them off as being demonically possessed. And I also met a man who was a Buddhist Christian. He was a chaplain at the local hospital. And I began interacting with him. And he was just the most, he had been a monk for 7 years. This is an amazing guy. And he was the most Christ-like, thoughtful, compassionate, amazing, present person that I had ever met. And yet, my theology at the time said he was going to hell, that I should get him saved or invite him to accept Jesus as his personal Lord and Savior, because he was just like clearly too liberal. And yet my head said, get him saved. But my heart said, ask him to mentor you, because he was so amazing, so Christ-like. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was the combination of those two things, the biblical studies and philosophy professors at Evangel, and Tobias Meeker, this amazing individual, that really broadened my world at that point.
Now, I'm aware that eco-theologian Thomas Berry has been a big influence in both of your thinking and has really inspired you further along this road. Can you say a little bit about Thomas Berry, who he is, why he's so significant, and, you know, how he inspired you on the track that you're on now?
Yeah, sure. In 1988, I was pastoring my first church, which was a United Church of Christ congregation in western Massachusetts. In fact, I was the pastor of the only church in a town of 1,500 people, so I was the town parson. And I took a class in Boston. I drove 2 hours for a three-hour course one night for 6 weeks with Albert LaChance, who had studied one-on-one with Father Thomas Berry for 5 years. The course was called The New Catholic Mysticism. And the first night, about a half hour into the program, I had goosebumps, I started to cry, and I realized I was going to spend the rest of my life popularizing this sacred evolutionary perspective. It was a total appointment with destiny. And it was February 1st, 1988, and I know that I began immediately after that, waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and reading books and watching videotapes and cassette tapes, listening to them, and just I immersed myself in this universe story. And so Thomas Berry's work has been, and then of course I met Father Thomas maybe 6 months after that, and so he's been a very significant influence in my own life.
Mm-hmm. And Thomas, for me, came a little bit later into my discovering of the great story, the epic of evolution. While I was working on my science books, I was reading all kinds of classic books in evolutionary biology and got on to the works of Julian Huxley, who was an amazing evolutionary humanist. He died in, I think, 1974, so I was reading his books long after he had died. And it was through his books where I realized that all this evolution, the science that I loved and had been studying, was actually more than just a bland worldview. It was, as in the title of one of his stellar books, was a religion without revelation, that it was a religion through discovery. It could give you the same sense of how things came to be and excitement for life and what our human destiny and purpose is. And he was a magnificent writer. So it was through his works that I first resonated with the thought that what is the role of the human? I mean, I had, as an ecological activist, I had started to feel that humans were a real blight on the planet. And it was through encountering the works of Julian Huxley where he said, through the human, the universe, evolution itself has become conscious of itself. It's gotten to know its own story. And I started to think, wow, there is a role for the humans. There is a role for us. Maybe we shouldn't just go extinct. And then when I encountered Thomas Berry while I was living in New York and started seeing him in meetings about once a month with the American Teilhard Association, that I eventually became on the board of, I learned through Thomas Berry that it wasn't enough just to know the universe story, the 14 billion year story of the universe. Thomas said that our role was not just to know, but it was to celebrate. That we are the celebrants of this grand epic of evolution. And through that, I realized scientists were not at the top of the heap. Artists and anyone with depth of heart and young children who loved to draw pictures of dinosaurs, all these were doing exactly what the human's role in the cosmos were.
How did this understanding that our role is to celebrate the evolutionary story, how has that played out in your own life? What is that sense of celebration?
Oh, I got to take that one. I used to write books exclusively for adults. In fact, there's only one of my siblings, and my whole family has even gotten through most of any of my books. Now, a lot of what I do is either for kids or for grown-ups who want to learn the story of the universe in playful ways, evolutionary parables, cosmic rituals kinds of things where we can, in very playful ways, learn the universe story. One of the things that I love to do, for example, for kids is many kids have seen the movie The Lion King. Mm. And love that movie. In fact, I go...
A few adults have seen it, too.
Yeah.
From what I understand.
And some kids, they don't know why, but it's become their mythic story. Well, one of the things that goes on in there, as in many Disney movies, the death of the father. The death of the father. This is a wonderful way to introduce children into the role of death. And so what I do is where the Lion King has a situation in there where the Lion King father is telling the little Simba, his son, Simba, what the stars are. And said, Simba, our ancestors are the stars. That's what happens when you die. And even when I'm dead, you can look to the stars and I'll be there to guide you. So after the Lion King does die and Simba becomes an adolescent, it's having that connection to the stars that bring him into his own to re-enter the circle of life as an adult. So I'll talk to kids that story and I'll ask them, I'll say, how many of you think that the Lion King was right, that stars really are our ancestors? And most of them go, no. You know, we all know it's like the warthog said, big balls of burning gas billions of miles away. Right. And then I'll let them know. I'll teach them this whole story of stardust. Mm. about where the calcium came from and show them the Hubble space photos. They love the pictures of the Hubble space photo. I have these big photos I carry around with me. And I'll show them these photos. And the kids love it. And I'll sing songs to them. So it's a way for me to now move into a different phase where I know just as much of the science, but I'm translating it in ways that children and the child within adults can love and where we can learn by way of stories.
Yeah, and that's the piece that I think that we offer that is our one of the things that gives us life and fills our joy buttons and juice and what just brings us alive is to not just tell the universe story as a story, but to ritualize it, to share it in various ways so that people get that this is a sacred story, that this helps us know who we are, you know, where we came from, what our role is, and how we can understand differences, religious differences, philosophical differences. And so, I mean, that's more abstract. But that young people, children, teenagers can get a sense that this is their story, that each of us is the universe becoming aware of itself. Each of us is a cell in the body of God, to use more religious language. But each of us is an expression of this holy process, and that our role now is to further it in this direction towards greater interdependence and cooperation at larger and wider scale. So there's a whole there's a whole religious insight. In fact, the distinction between religion and science or science and spirituality begins to blur. Not that they're the same thing, but that religion is more grounded in empirical reality than many people have experienced. And science can speak a more meaningful, heartful understanding of the nature of things than many people have been exposed to.
And in fact, one of the things we'll often get asked about creationism versus what we're doing or intelligent design, what we're doing. And a lot of people, you know, they just kind of assume we're going to come down on, well, they don't have the truth. Michael and I, what we're committed to is that those with the best story win. And what we're committed to doing is telling the best story. What kids are not going to want to learn? That they can go out and look at Orion this time of year in the constellation Orion, look in that left shoulder of Orion the Hunter and see the reddish star there, Betelgeuse, and know that ancestor stars, just like Betelgeuse, created all the oxygen, every single oxygen atom they're now breathing. What child isn't going to want to learn that the dinosaurs that they're seeing in museums are part of this whole vast history of life, and that they're related, the salty tears that they cry are related, are there because their ancestors, their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents once swam in the ocean. What kids aren't going to want to learn that? So that's what we're committed to. We think that this story, and all the time, science is just revealing magnificent things that we can use the Hubble Space Telescopes. I view those as religious icons. And when we can use those, we've got the kids.
Yeah.
In the way you're speaking about it, one almost gets a sense that a new myth is emerging.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. In fact, that's what I remember when Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyer were talking years ago. That's what Joseph Campbell was saying, was that a new myth grounded in the whole world, the whole universe. And it's a meta-religious orientation. It's not a religion in competition with existing religions. It's an orientation that nurtures, that feeds, and that expands every religious tradition on the planet and yet allows them or helps them, ushers them into a greater understanding of their own truths.
Most of us these days, the way we get to hear about the evolution story is we're seeing in the mainstream media constantly this polarity. You've got the hardline evolutionists on one hand, you've got creationism on the other hand, and they're at war. And I think a lot of us feel like, well, we don't side with either one, and we're not quite sure where to go with this whole picture. And, of course, now then there's intelligent design, which has come into the dialogue. And, again, that's something that I think a lot of us don't really know quite how all this fits together. And I just want to – is what you're speaking about, is that intelligent design? Is that?
No, not at all. In fact, we think the way I say it is that intelligent design, I think the problem with it is that it trivializes both God and science.
So what is intelligent design in a nutshell?
Intelligent design is a philosophy. It's a worldview that tries to argue, and I think fairly effectively in some ways, that there are places in the evolutionary story, there are places – they don't use the evolutionary – but there are places in the history of the universe where – there seems to be irreducible complexity. You can't get from here to there simply by chance alone. And so they say, well, that's evidence of God. And from the perspective that we're offering, this great story perspective, God is nothing so trivialized. God is a sacred name, a proper name for the whole of reality, measurable and non-measurable, seen and unseen. In other words, the analogy that I like to use so that people can visualize what I'm talking about is nesting dolls. That a fundamental truth, kind of like Russian nesting dolls, you know, mm-hmm. a fundamental truth that we now understand through the sciences is that reality is comprised of nested spheres of creativity, subatomic particles within atoms, within molecules, within cells, within organisms, within planets, within galaxies. In other words, all the way up and all the way down, every level is creative. There's a creativity within the process itself. In other words, creativity, ultimate creativity, isn't just that reality at the beginning of time that makes everything. Creativity pervades the universe in this nested sense, and we couldn't have understood this prior to telescopes, microscopes, and computers. So it's not like earlier generations are faulted for not knowing this. This is a genuine revelation. It's a revelation of God that is a revelation of what's so, what's true, what's the nature of reality, which is also simultaneously a scientific discovery. And so this sense of nested creativity that's leading in a direction of greater interdependence and cooperation, in other words, complexity at larger and wider scale, allows us to see, to use language that talks about God that bridges all the differences. For example, from this perspective, God is a sacred name or a proper name for ultimate reality, the only reality that's not included in some larger, more comprehensive reality. In other words, that reality that includes all other realities yet transcends all the other realities. And in this sense, God is not something that can be believed in or not believed in. In fact, any God that can be believed in or not believed in is precisely what I'm not talking about.
Mm-hmm.
God is either a sacred name for the whole of reality, measurable or non-measurable, seen and unseen, transcendent and immanent, or God is but a figment of our imaginations. And so this way of thinking about God, I had this one woman, she was 82, 83 years old, sprightly thing, a little 4'11" woman. She came up after my program at what church I did. This was a Unitarian Universalist church. My program was called Can the Universe Be Trusted? And I used God language in the way that I just did.
Mm-hmm.
And she came up afterwards and she said, I need to tell you. She said, I'm an atheist, but I'm excited. You've made it okay to use God language here in our church. And I found that evangelical Christians, liberal Christians, as well as I've done Buddhist meditation centers and groups of atheists and free thinkers, all can relate to this way of talking about the divine.
Just so I get this straight, because I think for most of us, if most of us who are in some way sort of spiritually inclined and yet we're trying to make peace with evolution and evolutionary theory, we want to see that, well, it's not all random mutation and natural selection that created the whole process. There was some kind of intelligence behind it, and that's why intelligent design and that sort of thing feels, you know, there's sympathy with that. In what you're saying, are you saying that even if it were random mutation and natural selection, it's still divine? The way you're speaking about God is that big?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's emergent. Mm. There's emergent intelligence. Not just that there's intelligence behind it. Mm. That may or may not be. We ultimately, I don't think, can know.
Mm.
But there's intelligence within the process. Or I say intelligence. There's creativity within the process. The old distinction of is it random chance or is it determined?
Right.
It breaks down. It's creative.
Mm-hmm.
It's create, which has elements of both randomness and chance and constraints, things that had to be.
And for myself, having come of age during the feminist era, one of the things I like, and I'm a straight, you know, neo-Darwinian in terms of evolutionary biology. That's really my roots. But one of the things that I love about it is that from the standpoint of how it really happens, it's organisms in interaction with other organisms, in interaction in an environment of non-living atmosphere and sun and all this kind of thing. And it's the interaction that makes it all happen. It's all an interaction. And so the way I like to view, if there is one word that I had to choose for what is evolution most like, one word to use, I would use the word conversation. Because a conversation is two or more beings in interaction, intensely in interaction, right here in the moment, like we are, and without really a sense of where things are going. And that's where I feel the intelligence comes from. As anyone who's been in an intense conversation knows, you get out of it and you go, wow, where did those ideas come from? It's the same way in evolution. It's the same kind of emergent creativity. And this is something that our great evolutionary biologists, including Julian Huxley and Theodosius Dobzhansky, have forever been saying.
Now, you two have been saying that part of the human piece in all this, or what's emerged as the human role in evolution, is that we can in some way consciously participate in the process now.
Right.
And just based on what Connie was just saying about conversation, can you say a little bit about how you see humans able to participate consciously in it? What kinds of things we can do that are going to go more in a more evolutionary direction, if that's the kind of language you could use?
Well, one of the things, Craig, is that we're becoming aware of the dynamics of evolution itself. So we're becoming aware of how evolution has worked for 14 billion years. What has led to it? What have been the dynamics? How does evolution work? And to the degree that we become conscious of that, we can then participate in that conscious evolution consciously. In other words, we can participate in the process of evolution with a conscious understanding of how it works, and to the degree that we understand that, we can then align our laws, our medicine, our politics, our economics, our education, our social structures with the way evolution works, and then we can move into a just, healthy, sustainable, life-giving future for us and all species. Mm-hmm. To the degree that we ignore how evolution works, then we will be at odds with the way God has been doing things for 14 billion years, or the goddess, if you will. I mean, however you want to understand or call ultimate reality. Human beings are like nature, going off automatic onto manual.
Mm.
But we haven't been operating with the wisdom of the whole, because we've been operating, as Brian Swim talks about, we've been operating with microphase wisdom but macrophase powers. So we have big impact, but we're only now beginning to humble ourselves and learn from our non-human, more than human, larger body of life, and gain guidance, gain wisdom, because that's how God has been speaking. That is how the whole of reality has been speaking for 14 billion years, is through the entire body of life.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in kind of a reversal on what our usual parts are on this. And Michael's talking kind of the rational side of understanding evolution and then participating in the same dynamics, consciously so. And what I've enjoyed over the past number of years is taking more of what might be considered a sort of a spiritual or mystical approach. And that is, I'm very partial to a phrase that Andrew Cohen uses. It's called the evolutionary impulse. And that is, do we have a sense, if we as humans living right here now, evolution is not just outside of us. We're no less a part of the Earth community in the universe than stars and planets and worms and jellyfish. We are part of it. And the evolutionary impulse is also working through us. So for me, it's kind of an intuitive sense of, where do I feel drawn to be in action in the world, to make a difference in the small scale, the big scale, in ways I can't even know? And if it feels right, I don't even have to be like an engineer, like designing it, to know this action will lead to this and this and this, and therefore it will do good. What feels right? Mm. And so for me, it's a very spiritual sense of, why am I on the road now? There are hardships being on the road, and yet it feels like the right thing to do, but I can't explain why.
And in a sense, in the way you're speaking about it, that deep intuitive sense, you can see that not just as some kind of personal preference, but as kind of the part of you that is that original God or creative impulse that gave birth to the whole thing, still creating, still looking for, where's my piece in this? How
absolutely,
can I take it
further? Absolutely, absolutely. And for me, it's comforting that a single human mind wouldn't be able to grasp necessarily where they play a role, that we really are in conversation not only with all other humans, but with the whole Earth community, and taking our inspiration for that. And I love the sense that I really don't know, and I can't know.
In fact, there's an exercise that I always invite people to do, which is to take a piece of paper and draw a line down the middle. So they've got two columns. And on the left-hand side, to list all the things that they love to do that light them up, that give them joy, that give them a sense of energy and fulfillment and happiness, you know, things they're good at, things other people tell them good at, etc. And at the top of that list, you put my great joy. And then on the right-hand side, to list all the things that they're aware of in the world, where they feel the world's needs, like not just where they intellectually know about what the world needs or what their community needs, but where they really feel it, where they get upset or frustrated or depressed, and especially where they feel compassion. And then to simply pay attention to their heart. They don't have to call it prayer or meditation, but just to pay attention to their heart and ask the guidance from right there, where are the potential intersections between what lights them up, what gives them joy, what gives them energy, and what the world's needs are, or their community's needs as they feel them. And those places of intersection where your great joy and the world's great needs intersect, that's your calling, that's your mission, that's your vocation. And even though, as Connie said, there's some hardships about living on the road and living in people's homes and this sort of thing, sleeping in the van when it's 9 degrees, we feel called to do this in that sense, is that this is where our great joy and the world's great needs intersect.
You're really saying that this kind of this way of speaking, this evolutionary framework, this evolutionary impulse Connie mentioned, is in a sense a kind of, it becomes a kind of spiritual basis or background for one's life. Now, spirituality and religion conventionally, traditionally, have been very much about morality, about what guides our actions. And you're speaking about a kind of way of tuning in oneself. But in maybe a larger sense or a philosophical sense, what would you say is the basis of morality in this new evolutionary worldview? If everything's constantly changing, where are the absolutes that can guide our behavior?
Great question. Thank you for asking that. Because for me, this is some of the most exciting thing. This is the real growing edge for Connie and I in terms of what we're presenting.
And we view it, it's also one of the things, there's a big group here of teenagers and young adults with how do you, I can reach the kids with Stardust. We can reach the grown-ups, you know, that have been in careers for a while and are sort of floundering on these other things. But how do you reach the teens? How do you reach the youth? And it's this area of understanding morality and understanding the challenges that we have to work with.
Yeah, the whole field of evolutionary psychology, evolutionary ethics, growing out of this whole body of research that understands our inherited proclivities, these inner drives, these inner nature that is common, that's universal to all humans, and giving people a window into how that works and how they can live in integrity and joy and freedom. Very exciting stuff.
How does this evolutionary understanding inform our moral choices that we face every day?
Yeah, great question. It does so in two ways, or at least two ways, probably more. One is that understanding the directionality to the flow of evolution as a whole. Again, not every species is becoming more complex. But when you look from the perspective of the whole of creation, the whole of the universe, we see this direction towards greater, or this emerging of greater complexity, interdependence, cooperation at larger and wider scale. First, you had single-celled prokaryotic bacteria, which then joined together in cooperatives called eukaryotics, the eukaryotic cell, and then multicellular organisms, and then mammals. And then in the human realm, we see societies going increasingly complex from when we cooperated at the scale of a family and clan, and then with language, we began cooperating at the scale of a tribe, and then, you know, kingdoms and chiefdoms, and then states, and so forth. And now we're cooperating in many ways as a whole planet. So clearly, from this perspective, understanding directionality and human universals, this, what do we all have in common? We all are drawn to, for example, foods with fats, sugars, and salts. We are drawn to, especially we high testosterone alpha male types, are drawn to pollinate more than one flower, so to speak. I mean, we find these inherited proclivities. We're selfish. We're self-seeking. We're status-seeking. These are universals, true for all humans. You could call this original sin. That is, these inherited proclivities have served our ancient ancestors. None of us would be here. None of us would be listening to this program or on this program if it weren't for some of our ancestors that didn't, you know, play around a little bit. And yet, these tendencies, these parts of us that we don't choose, we're just born with these. How do we be in radical integrity such that these energies serve our life and help us to be a blessing to the future, help us to be a contribution to life? And so, and these are universals.
And this aspect of the evolutionary story, I think, is what is so exciting for the youth and for teens, where they're really first starting to feel hormones, and also where they can going to school puts you in a place where you can buy all sorts of drugs in ways that I, as a normal adult, just don't fall into. They have to learn to say no in ways that I, as an adult, just don't have to. And so what can this evolutionary story give our youth, and give our teens, that can be really helpful in this very difficult time of life? Well, one thing, first of all, is something that all religions and higher forms of enlightenment have tried to do, and that is self-understanding, self-acceptance, not being in denial. And so there's a sense of almost like a relief of, oh, you mean there's nothing intrinsically wrong with me that I feel like I want to do X, or that when I drink such and such, I feel like I want to have more. No, This is all part of our heritage deep within us. Scientists, not, well, 30 years ago or so, came up with the understanding that the human brain was not designed from the outside as an engineering feat to be what kind of a brain do we need for humans? Not at all. What we have is what's called a triune brain. Starts off with the reptilian brain that served our reptilian ancestors. And basically, our reptilian ancestors needed to find food. They needed to be able to fight off and flee from defenders. And they needed to be able to reproduce. Basic drives. And these drives are still the ones. This is the source of our addictions in a culture in which food is everywhere. Everywhere, and in a culture in which the situation is very different from before. We also have a paleo mammal brain, and this is the part that causes me the most trouble. I have been so thrilled personally to learn that I have an amygdala. Now, for those of you who don't know what an amygdala is, it's part of the limbic system. It evolved in the early mammal stage, and we still have it. It's the emotional relational brain. It tells us, I love, I fear, I envy, I greed, all of these kinds of things, and I am so angry. And when the amygdala is triggered, we can't just take our rational brain, our neocortex, our human chatterbox brain that's been built on over the top of our old mammal brain and say, stop, you shouldn't feel that way. No, what I've learned through this evolutionary understanding is I call upon my reptilian brain. And my reptilian brain is the one that knows how to move and how to breathe. It does all that for me. And I say, go for a walk and let the amygdala calm down. Mm. Now, until I knew that, I thought there was something wrong with me. Why can't I just tell my brain to do this? So evolutionary psychology works for me in this regard. I have a niece that just turned on in college in a biology course, turned on to evolutionary psychology by reading Robert Wright's The Moral Animal. And now she gets absolutely delighted. She's developing what people in meditation call the witness capacity. And that is where, instead of just immediately reacting to your emotional triggers, you step back for a moment and go, huh, I see I'm feeling such and such. And now she does, and she says, isn't it amazing? This served my 780th great-great-great-great-grandmother. But you know what? I don't think it's serving me now. It's amazing.
And young people are so responding. I preached on this topic called the gospel according to evolution. No, it was the good news according to evolution just a couple of weeks ago. And there was about, oh, I don't know, dozen and a half young teenagers, 11 to 15-year-olds that had come to my Sunday sermon. And nine of them came to the follow-up workshop on Tuesday night. And many of them had gone to their parents and said, we need to be there Tuesday night. Not can we come, but we need to be there. And that had never happened before. And it was because I was introducing this evolutionary psychology, and they realized there was something here that was going to be of value to them.
And we've just started adding this into our program. It's not something that other people in the Universe Story Epic of Evolution movement are doing. Kind of got started through my experience with my niece, but also very recently in the Pacific Northwest, I was talking with a radical nun, and she said, we were talking about something, and she said, oh, well, of course, I don't believe in original sin anymore. And I thought, well, maybe there is something useful about original sin, because if we don't believe in original sin, then if I fall into these traps, if I fall into ways of being and emotionally reacting in ways that I don't like or I view as bad, then maybe there's something wrong with me. And so if we understand evolutionary psychology, we can take a dose of original sin back in and let our youth know that they're going to experience these challenges and there's nothing wrong with them. And that the main thing that our evolutionary morality can do, we're discovering human universals about love and care and so forth. The main thing we see we need to do is the distinction between who's part of your in-group and who's part of your out-group. And that's the differences that we now have. If we can find ways to teach this such that we see that not only are all other humans throughout the planet part of our home family, their kin, but so are all the creatures, we will have moved to the next step in which truly the inherited proclivities we have to be good and cooperate with our kin truly becomes global.
Yeah, Michael Shermer's new book, The Science of Good and Evil, the subtitle is Why People Share, Care, Gossip, and Follow the Golden Rule. And it's just, it's all about evolutionary ethics and what are the human universals. There's just a lot of exciting work that's been done in this field lately.
So I know you both feel that this evolutionary story and this kind of understanding that you're sharing here can not only help us kind of navigate our personal lives, but in some sense, I know you both feel very hopeful and very passionately that this becomes an inspiration to really start to evoke real world change, to transform the world.
Absolutely. Well, although I typically don't use the word transform the world because the world is already evolving. Mm. But I believe that in my lifetime, I'm only 47, I believe that we are seeing a coming together of so many different movements. And we're recognizing, for example, that to participate with evolution is to co-create a way of governing ourselves as a species and a way of organizing ourselves economically such that individuals, corporations, and nation states that are naturally self-interested, all entities are self-interested, to align that self-interest with the well-being of the whole. So to create a system, a way of governing ourselves so that individuals, corporations, and nation states that cooperate and serve the common good, they benefit. And the more good they do to the common good, the more they benefit. And individuals, corporations, and nation states that disregard or harm the common good are taxed or penalized in some way. In other words, it makes it so that the system is designed such that corporations and individuals, by pursuing their natural self-interest, are going to serve the common. And it's not that tough. This Bill McDonough's work is just so on that we need to redesign the systems so that the cheaper, easier, more convenient thing to do is the right thing to do, which is not the way the system's designed right now. But it's because we're young, we're immature.
And it's easy for us, Michael and me, to be optimistic about seeing what this worldview, it's meta-religious, how it can move into all different worldviews, secular and sacred. It's easier for us to be optimistic about it because, again, we're on the road. And almost all of our programs we do for free, mm-hmm. which means people don't have to already be into the universe story movement or into the epic of evolution movement and say, oh boy, you got to come and see this. And because we're doing church services where people are coming anyway to church and they have no idea what they're going to get. And so we have the joy of seeing people who've never been exposed to these ideas before instantly awaken to them.
It's like a mission field. I mean, there's always a dozen people who just like, whoa, this has changed my life. Or actually a more common comment is, you know, I've never heard it quite put together like this, yet I've always known this is true. Mm. It's like this sense of it resonates with a deep part of their being. And I live for that. I live to see people just have this kind of conversion or awakening or just like they get something, especially liberals who are very passionately committed to a just, healthy, sustainable, life-giving future. We liberals can get overwhelmed with the bad news.
Sure.
And so this offers a hopeful, inspiring way of thinking about the future because it's based on deep understandings of the trends of the past.
And because once you get it at the level of wonder and awe and feeling as I had one nun come up to me after seeing Michael, and she said, you know, I finally got it. The universe is not just something out there. The universe is also within me.
Yeah, I am the universe.
I am the universe. And when people get that, suddenly we no longer have to use our rational brains to figure everything out. We can really just not even try to have faith and trust. We just have it.
Connie,
amen.
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 Connie and Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Craig.
Thank you, Craig.